Well, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Jeff Belanger as we talk about all things haunted. Why don't you share one of your haunted stories with us? Jeff would love to hear it. We'll be back with him, and we'll talk about some more of his stories in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Jeff Belanger. Jeff's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Jeffrey, tell us about this haunted cemetery in western Massachusetts.
Yeah, so this is a story that takes place on October Mountain in the Berkshires, and it's a beautiful mountain. It's called October Mountain because Herman Melville actually named it, of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he lived in Pittsfield, Mass.
And Moby Dick, the great author. Yep.
That's right. So, beautiful mountain, especially in the fall. And I'd heard about this abandoned cemetery that was haunted by the ghost of a little girl. And the first time I went up there was, oh gosh, maybe 15 years ago. Now, October Mountain's 45,000 acres. It's the largest state forest in Massachusetts. And all I knew was that it was somewhere near the top. And myself and three other people went searching. And by the way, also Bigfoot sightings on this mountain and UFO sightings. But on this day, we were looking for a ghost. And looked all over, didn't find it, struck out. I got to go back a few years later with a PBS film crew and a guy that knew where the cemetery was. And it turns out there used to be a logging community up there that was, you know, a few houses and things like that, and a cemetery and maybe 25 graves. And he took us right to it. And as we were walking along the side, now picture this, the area, I mean, not even a quarter of an acre, an eighth of an acre, maybe tiny. And all the headstones are knocked over, and as we walk up the left side, I see a grave on its back, and it says, Anna Pease, age 10 years, 9 months. And I went, wow, there's a little girl buried here. This is amazing. And so we aired the special on PBS, and I said, this is great. You know, a ghost story led me up that mountain, and we got to give the ghost a name. It was an awesome story. It was great. And I thought that was the end of it. But a year later, when it was playing in a rerun, a local man who's also named Pease reached out to the producer and said, hey, I'm a Pease. That was one of my ancestors. I would really like to find that grave.
Ah.
So we get the crew together, and we go to interview him, and he owns this little music shop in Palmer, Massachusetts, and we're talking to him. His family's in for Thanksgiving. And there's no way to describe how to get to this place, right? I'd be like, there's a big tree, and you make a left. I mean, so we say, okay, we'll take you up there. And we took the whole family up there, and they carried with them an antique pump organ. And they played the song Gentle Annie by Stephen Foster right there by Anna Pease's graveside. And I was thinking about how incredible this moment was, right? So even if you don't believe in ghosts, a ghost story led me up that mountain all those years ago.
Huh.
And telling the story reunited a family. I mean, that grave probably hadn't been visited in over a century.
If they even knew it was there.
If they even, and now suddenly people do know it was there. And just in exploring and telling the story, there was this sense of bringing it back together. And there's a Mexican parable that talks about how we all die three deaths, right? The first is when your body expires. The second is when you're laid into the ground. But the third and final death comes somewhere down the road. And that happens when your name is uttered for the last time. Anna Pease is still with us. We said her name, her family, her descendants, you know, people that have a connection to her, laid roses at her grave. And in a very real and tangible way, she's still with us.
Now, this story is not haunted, but you claim that it was not Kitty Hawk where we got the first flight, but that someplace in Boston.
Not just someplace in Boston. The Old North Church. You know, one if by land, two if by sea, that Old North Church.
And Kitty Hawk was 1903, right?
1903, and we're talking about something that took place in 1757.
You're talking about flight occurred in the 1700s?
Before balloon flight, too, by decades.
By who?
So here's what happened. On the church, there's this curious little plaque. And everybody goes to see the Old North Church in Boston, and they know all about, you know, the British are coming and all that other stuff. But there's a little plaque on the side of the building, and it says 1757 to 1923. And I'll read from it. It says, here on September 13th, 1757, John Childs, who had given his public notice of his intention to fly from the steeple of Dr. Cutler's church, performed it to the satisfaction of a great number of spectators.
My gosh.
1923 was the first year of the continuous flight across the continental United States, and the tablet was placed there to commemorate two events. 1757. Not only did he do it, George, I did some digging. He did it more than once. And not only did he do it more than once, it then became illegal to fly from tall buildings in Boston. So he ruined it for all of us.
What did he do? Have wings or what?
So it turns out, and this was a matter of debate for the longest time, because there's this plaque right on the side of the building. You have to know where to find it. It's small. It turns out John Childs was a kind of medieval daredevil called a rope flyer. And what rope flyers would do was tie a rope to a tall building, secure it very tight, down at an angle. They would strap a board to their chest with a groove in it, and they would put that rope right in the groove.
Oh, and they'd just fly down the rope, almost like a tightrope walker.
Right. Yeah. And it's now illegal in Boston. To this day, you can't do that in the city of Boston.
I'll still give it to the Wright brothers.
Yeah, I think we have to, in all fairness.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to James in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, to get stuff started here. Hey, James, welcome.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Long-time listener, big fan.
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate your show. Just on, if you may, on a lighter note, we were talking about graveyards and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
My oldest brother, who since passed away, but back in the day when people would go to parties and so forth and they dressed up in suit coats and ties and everything, well, he went to one. And he got a little loop, okay? So he didn't have a car. So on the way back home, he cut through a graveyard. And he was so drunk, he fell into a future grave that was
Dug out. The body wasn't in there yet.
No. And he fell in. And he slept. And sun come up and everything. And he got up and was crawling out, and the groundskeeper was coming by, and he saw that.
thought some body was crawling out, right?
He was put in a mental facility for about a year.
That is funny.
A family story.
I love that. That's something you're never going to forget.
And suddenly, a legend is born, right? Not just within a family, but I'm sure the groundskeeper's telling stories, and that's a good one.
Can you imagine the look of that groundskeeper seeing a body crawling out of the grave?
I imagine it takes a certain temperament to have that job in the first place, you're okay with being around dead people all the time. And I get it. I've talked to funeral directors, and they said, it's never the dead that bother you. It's the living. And I can sort of understand that. But, when you see one crawling out of the ground, that's a game changer.
What has been, in your career, the craziest story you've ever heard, Jeff?
Oh, my gosh. It's...
That you put in one of your books, let's say.
Yeah, no, I think it usually comes down to the living people, right? But I like when a story gets legs, when it turns out that there's something to it. So the Berkshire Mountain story, right? So that's something where suddenly a ghost of a little girl gets a name and then reunites a family. And that's really quite profound. But I think sometimes, the wackier side of things is, one woman I interviewed once had told me the story about how her grandmother had died, and she and they were all upset because she had some nice jewelry that the family wanted to make sure was taken care of, that stayed in the family and things like that.
And not be buried with her, probably.
Not be buried with her and not, get sold in some estate sale or anything like that. And her grandmother, as can happen in her later years, got quite forgetful, and didn't know where she was leaving things. And so everybody's petrified that it's in the oddest place that nobody would think to look. And it was about a week after the funeral, and they're just starting to get through her things and what they're going to sell and give away and keep and things like that. And this woman said she kept having this dream about a couch. And the couch was, she said, grandma's couch was not in good shape. That was just going in the dump. And something about the couch just kept coming up in her dreams, and she thought twice about it, and she went to her grandmother's house the day they were cleaning everything out, opened up the cushions, and found her grandmother's jewelry.
Wow.
And she believed this was a message. This was her saying, that's where it is. Go find it. Don't make sure it's not thrown out.
You are a believer in the afterlife by now, aren't you?
I am. Oh, absolutely. I've had experiences I can't explain. I've lost loved ones and feel they're still with me in some very tangible way, for sure.
Let's go to Gunter in Maryland. Welcome to the program. Hi, Gunter. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There was an estate in Virginia by the Lee family, and one day she just died, or so they thought she did. They put her in a chapel. A lot of these big estates have a little chapel, so they get her ready to bury her. Well, at night she got up and banged on the door to be let in. And, of course, the rest, after a few years, she bore a son. And that son was Robert E. Lee.
You're kidding.
No.
What a story.
I mean, that's what I thought. You may want to check that out.
I will do that. Jeff, I guess in those days they didn't embalm people, did they?
Right. No.
That's why they didn't die.
Well, embalming was a trend that started kind of after the Civil War. It was sort of expensive. So... And seemed frivolous to a lot of people. You know, it was just, well, you're dead. You put them in the ground. Like, there was sort of a sensibility to it. But embalming, as it got less expensive and became more, you know, funeral customs are trendy, right? There's different trends. Look at the way headstones look. Just look at 200 years of headstones. The old death heads with, like, a skull and bones on it from 200 years ago. No one would do that today, although I would love one.
Well, nowadays, if you're not dead at the funeral home, you will definitely be dead before you leave it.
That's right. Of course you will, because of the embalming. And so all these customs and things like that, yeah, people did get buried prematurely. You did hear those stories where they weren't quite dead and moved along. And people were afraid. And I mentioned 16 patents filed for devices to keep you from being buried alive. And that's not the undertaker selling you that, right? I mean, that's not the undertaker saying, well, in case I have no idea how to tell the difference between a living and a dead body, I could sell you the life detector, a spring-loaded bell or whatever, you know? These are people that are seeking this stuff out to have and to use just in case. And that's there's something to that, right? Like, are we that afraid? Do we want to be immortal? I mean, it speaks to a certain part of the psyche, doesn't it?
One of your books is called Our Haunted Lives. Tell me about that one.
So Our Haunted Lives is a collection of interviews with people that have had profound ghost experiences. And I did my best to either rip off, you could say, or homage the great Studs Terkel. You know, I wanted to keep myself out of it. And really, I wanted you to hear the voices of the people that had the experiences. And the book starts with a very lengthy interview I conducted with George Lutz, who, of course,
was
in the Amityville House.
That's
right. And we talked about everything from, you know, the year before he moved into that house to present day, and his lawsuits and his gag orders and everything else in and around that story. And what I found so compelling, especially with George's story, and I've only heard a couple people ever say this, you know, he described some pretty frightening things. Nothing like what was in the book by Jay Anson, certainly nothing like the movies, but still frightening experiences. For example, he said he'd be in bed at night and he would hear what sounded like a marching band downstairs, just sort of like warming up. And he gets up and he walks down the steps and he sees his black lab sound asleep at the bottom of the steps. And so, of course, he's questioning his sanity, right? If there was really sound, the dog would have woken up and started barking. And so he thinks this thing, whatever it is singling him out. And then pretty soon, as the family starts to communicate, they realize they're all having their own weird experiences. And they were all afraid to tell the others for fear of scaring someone or thinking they're crazy or whatever. But when I said, you know, George, why wouldn't you just leave the house? Just get out, you know, a place like that. You know, 6 people were murdered in that house. That happened. That's a fact. And he said the house was charming.
Charming?
Charming. And that scared me more than anything, right? The idea that this horrible thing happened in the house you're living in. 6 people were murdered by their son/brother, right? Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. He's in jail to this day. He's in there right now.
Yeah.
And that happened. So that's already a little strange to live in a place like that. But then to say it's charming, that it's frightening, weird things are happening, you're not sleeping well, you're scared, but you're still charmed. You're under a spell. That, to me, is the most frightening thing that he had said, the idea that he didn't want to leave the house. It's like the house wanted him there. Scary stuff.
It is scary stuff. You love this stuff.
I do. And, you know, I went to college at Hofstra University, which is just a short distance from Amityville. And my freshman year, you know, first week, you know, you're making new friends and, oh, I'm from Amityville. And I said, oh, you're from Amityville. And he said, do you want to see the house? And I said, yes, I want to see the house. So he drove me by and I got to see it. And, you know, the neighborhood is quite dense. It's you picture it, this lone house on the hill. No, I mean, there's maybe 50 feet between houses. You know, they're very close together in a very nice neighborhood. Those windows are gone. But then you see it. And, man, there's a power to that. That you know what happened there. You know all the stories. And when you stand in front of it, you just gulp down a little bit. And that's how powerful a story can be, right? It can get under your skin and into your soul and just attach itself to you. And I think what's so compelling to me is that, you know, a horror took place in there, a true horror.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And that will haunt us. And it should haunt us. We should be haunted by that forever because something went so wrong that a son and a brother executed his whole family while they slept.
What caused the flies to attach to the window?
So I asked George about that, and he had said, you know, there were flies. He said it was not the swarm that was depicted in the movie or even in Jay Anson's book, The Amityville Horror. He said, but there was one room where there would always be a few flies, and you'd swat them, you'd get them out or whatever, and they would be back again and again, and he never could figure it out. And it was just one of those many unnerving little things. The thing about a real haunt, right, is it's not usually the house trying to eat you and swallow you up and spit you out. It's a million subtle things. And those subtle things are what chip away at your sanity. You know, if your house just started, you know, screaming at you and blood was pouring out of the walls, you'd just leave. You'd walk right out. You'd never go back.
That's right.
But it's hearing a
if
footstep.
You could.
Right? It's the little stuff.
Jeff Belanger with us. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to take more calls at the break when we come back. And share your stories with us, your haunted ones. I bet everybody has at least one scary story that they've went through. What do you think, Jeff?
Oh, at least. And the funny thing is, you know, I'm sure you've had the same experience. Like, oh, I don't believe in any of this stuff. And then, you know, a few minutes later, they pull you aside. Well, there was this one time. And you say, go ahead, tell me your one time.
There are some people, I guess, who still remain skeptical.
Sure, and that's
in spite of all these things happening, even to themselves.
Yep, of course. And I think we all have to do whatever we have to do to get through the night and wake up and look ourselves in the mirror. And some people completely shut it off and shut it down, and that's how they cope. And that's their way, and I won't argue with it. I'm one who wants to know.
Have you had stories of the devil with anything?
I have, and usually what happens is that's someone's interpretation, right? So
that's right.
They're scared, they think something bad is happening, and so they go to an extreme, right? They go all the way to, like, Satan, as opposed to just a ghost that might be present, right? So when people start saying devil or Satan or something like that, they're speaking from a position of a belief system, their belief system, right? And that's always tricky for me because I know we need labels. We live in a world that needs labels, but boy, they can also do a lot of harm.
One of your books is called The Nightmare Encyclopedia. Let's talk a little bit about that and take final calls when we come back, okay? Jeff Belanger, our special guest. Well, next hour, Pamisa Aloya joins us to talk about her latest work called The Daily Cloak. She is a certified grief counselor, but she's written a book about protecting your spirit. And we'll talk about that on Coast to Coast. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Jeff Belanger as we talk about his world of the haunted livings. You have a book called The Nightmare Encyclopedia, Jeffrey. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, when you sort of dive down the rabbit hole, I've said before, don't go halfway, right? Just keep going.
Just keep jumping in.
Just, get, you know, see where it leads you. And so many paranormal stories come up from people in the sleep state. And it got me kind of asking, you know, is there something to it? Is it more than just, you know, than a dream? What is a dream? Why do we sleep? All these things. And there's been many dream interpretation guides over the years, but how many just focused on nightmares? And those are the ones we remember, right? I remember a dream I had in high school that was so vivid. I was in an airplane. I remember where I was sitting on the plane. I remember what the people looked like sitting around me. And we were flying above above the clouds, and suddenly the plane goes dark. It shakes. We're spiraling downward. It was the scariest thing of my life. And I said, oh, I'm never going to fly again. I felt like I'd been through a plane crash.
Oh, of course.
And I didn't fly for years. And eventually, my yearning to see the world outweighed my fear of this dream. But I made myself a deal. I said, if I ever get on a plane and I'm sitting in that seat and I recognize the people around me from the dream, I'm off. I will
off that plane or yep. change that seat.
Yep. Just, nope. I'm moving. That's the deal I made. I'll miss that flight. But I remember that dream. This is decades ago. I remember it so vividly. And so I think a dream is a message from ourselves to ourselves, most simply put. And so a nightmare is a message that we're just not getting, or it's a really important message. And the language of the brain, our minds, is not, it's not as convenient as just saying, hey, George, you know, maybe you should cut back on the sugar this week, or maybe you've been having too much caffeine or whatever. The language of the brain is imagery. And so through imagery and metaphor, we have to interpret these dreams. And the best dream interpreter in the world is always going to be the person who had the dream. And so I kind of consulted many, many different encyclopedias and experts and started to put together this look at nightmares in pop culture, in music, in art, and so on, but also the interpretation and what they mean. And it was so fascinating. I started keeping a dream journal, and I found I learned a lot more about myself. And the whole point of the book was to kind of help others do the same thing. You know, this is a starting point for you, but then you can fit this imagery into the context of your own life.
Did you know the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley?
Oh, of course. Miss her every day.
Oh, me too. And
yeah,
what an expert in dreams.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, she did dream guides as well, and I know you guys worked on some books together.
Yep.
She's one of those souls. Like, I mean, talk about seeing people at events. I saw her all the time, and I feel there's just not enough prominent, really smart women out there in the paranormal, and she was one of them, you know.
She loved it.
Yep, it was her life, and
miss her a lot,
for sure.
Mike in Denver, Colorado. Michael, go ahead.
Hey George, good morning.
Thank
you so much for taking my call, and I have to say one of my favorite books is the one you co-wrote with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. So.
Talking to the Dead.
Talking to the Dead. Excellent book. I recommend it to everybody, and it kind of changed my life, actually. But it's kind of a conversation for another show, I guess. Jeff, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your interest and attention on the subject of vampires, and also your enthusiasm for covering the paranormal. A question tonight on vampires. When we talk about vampires in popular culture, such as the Twilight movies, for example, do you feel that popular culture and media accurately depicts vampires? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks for that question, Mike. So vampires have always changed to suit the times. And you know, once they got into the realm of fiction, you get to kind of like run wild with them, but they sort of reflect. Let me say this: I think the Twilight depiction, how wonderfully accurate if you put it into the context of COVID-19, right? They're teenagers. They go to high school. They blend in. They look like everybody else, except there's something about them that's just a little bit off. And that's what vampires do. If they were really obvious, then we would know to avoid the monster. And so I think in this case, yeah, they really do reflect the times. They always have. They've always had the ability to blend, and they've also always been a scapegoat. So anytime you don't have a logical reason for something, you can always blame the vampire. So, great question.
Most of your books are on hauntings. Have you ever compiled weird stories? I mean, just crazy things?
Yeah, so I did a book called Weird Massachusetts, part of the Weird U.S. series.
Back in 2008, I think.
Yeah, 2008, yeah. So I got to do the Massachusetts book. And one of the traps I think I fell into as a guy that researches this stuff is that I always assumed all the wonderful, strange places are far from home. You know, I think we fall into that trap, like, oh, far away is where the really interesting things are. And I spent a year just turning that eye toward where I live and finding so much great stuff and realizing, and that's true of everywhere, by the way, right? I mean, don't be enamored with faraway places. I mean, they're great too. And so, I mean, I looked into, you know, roadside oddities and strange funeral customs and headstones and curses and people and just legends of all kind. And I think that book really helped diversify me and realize that, you know, I love hauntings and ghosts. That's always going to be a big part of my life. But realizing that there's so much more out there that's worth exploring, that's worth understanding. That was sort of a turning point for me, 12 years ago now.
Let's go next to Mark in St. Louis. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen, good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good. Hey, George, this is Mark in St. Louis, your Gemini brother.
My pal. That's right.
So I was going to ask Jeff, sir, what is your take on the Salem witch trials, since we're talking about New England?
Yeah, so there's been many witch trials in New England. Salem is, of course, the most famous. There was one in Connecticut as well, decades earlier, that took 11 lives that people don't really talk about.
Oh,
so much.
Tragic.
Because it was hidden. So the Salem witch trials, Salem is a fascinating town, and I don't live too far from there, and I never tire of exploring that story. Because, of course, there were no witches. It was more about a land grab, but it was during a time where there were Native American wars going on. And this is part of the story that doesn't get told enough, that people are on edge, that preachers are preaching from the pulpit that the Native Americans are minions of Satan. And when you hear about villages getting attacked by Native Americans, who are just fighting back for their land, of course, you suddenly, that idea becomes very real to you, because you hear stories just a few miles away where whole families are killed by these marauding people. And so everyone's on edge. And so when someone says Satan is among us, it's easily believed by the folks that were going through it. It's a horrible tragedy on so many different fronts, but not the first or the last witch trials in New England, but the ones we know about. And we know about it because Salem got the nickname Witch City. We know about it because Arthur Miller wrote the play The Crucible in the 1950s and used it as a metaphor for McCarthyism. And that story gets told over and over, to the point when witch trial can mean anything from something that's happening at the highest level of government to something happening at your local PTA meeting. And an important story, because it's a lesson we clearly have not learned in centuries, right? There, we still have witch trials in every level of our lives. And maybe if we tell that story enough times, we'll make it a little better. That's my only hope.
Did they actually, Jeff, burn them at the stake?
No, they were hanged. Except Giles Corey. Giles Corey was pressed to death. Accused, by the way.
Like crushed.
Crushed. And the reason Giles Corey was pressed to death is because he refused to enter a plea, because he knew if he entered a plea of innocent and was found guilty, his land would be taken from him. So he stood mute. He entered no plea at all. And by entering no plea, they tried to press it out of him, and they just put rock after rock.
Oh.
And his last words in true New England fashion was, "More weight." And he died, and his family got to keep the land.
First-time caller, Anna in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello, Anna. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, George.
Hey,
George, I call you the Robert Goulet of the radio.
If ever I should leave you. Well, that's
I have two stories, actually. I don't think we'll have time for both, but they're both interesting. One was when I was in the Air Force. I spent 10 years in the Air Force.
Well, thank you for serving, by the way.
Yeah,
it was my pleasure. And it was about my aunt who had passed away. And the other is a story about, this is in the East. Like Thailand or somewhere like that. I think it maybe even Japan, where they have what they call the immortal monks. Have you ever heard of that?
I don't know that one, no.
No.
Well, check this out. These men, and believe me, a hundred and hundreds of men try this, okay? And only a few make it. And what they do is the year before they decide are going to become immortal. They eat grain that is tainted, this mixture that kind of petrifies or mummifies the inside of the body. And as the year, it's like 900 days or something. And as the days progress, they go into this, it looks like a cocoon teepee, kind of. And what made me think of it was when you were talking about the bell, because they have a bell that comes out of this little hole. And every day they go by the people that take care of him, and he rings the bell to tell them that he's still alive. And finally, of course, one day the bell no longer rings. And so they open this cocoon thing, and if he is mummified, then he is an immortal monk. And they actually show them. They're on display in a temple over there.
Wow.
Huh.
But hundreds, and there's a special name for them. I'm sorry, I can't think of it right now. But there's hundreds of men that die every year because they want to become this immortal monk, and only a few. I think there's like only 25 over hundreds of years.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's a book all by itself, Jeffrey. Anna, thank you. And again, thanks for serving in the Air Force. 10 years, that's a long, long time. Walt's with us in Pennsylvania. Walter, go ahead. You still there, Walt?
Stop for other depressing subjects.
You got it. Go ahead.
Georgia. You know, I think my favorite Super Bowl commercial of all was the old E.F. Hutton commercial where they're at the wake and the body sits up in the casket. I think that's on a humorous note. George, I got to mention, ask Mr. Blanger if you heard about Abe Lincoln, who was exhumed in 1901 after being encrypted for 36 years. And he was still recognizable after 36 years, believe it or not.
Huh. And, what did they exhume him for?
Well, his body was robbed a number of times. It was stolen out of his crypt. And finally, in 1901, his son Robert decided that they wanted to put him in a crypt that would be impervious to being stolen, so they dug a very deep, I think it was like 12 feet deep, and then they poured the wet concrete over the top of him, so he's permanently sealed. But before that, his son Robert wanted to make sure that the body was still in the coffin. So they opened the coffin in 1901, and they said that, according to the accounts I've read, that there was a fetid odor, you know, when they opened the coffin.
Oh,
but
I
he
bet.
Was still recognizable, and that was because after he died, they took him on this whistle-stop train tour of the country for about 2 to 3 weeks. And, from Washington, they took him up to Philadelphia and then to New York City for a few days. And every undertaker in that town would re-embalm him. Well, back then, they would, before embalming fluid, they would inject him with solutions containing arsenic and cadmium and mercury and zinc. And of course, this made the body impervious to any sort of bacterial or fungal or mold spores. And
he didn't decompose. It was slow. Do you remember the story where Abraham Lincoln had a dream that there was a body lying in state in the White House, and he walked up to it in his dream, looked in, and it was him? Do you remember that story, Jeff?
Yeah, I believe he had asked an aide, who's there? And he said, it's the president, sir.
Yeah,
and
it was him.
It was a premonition of his own death. He had two, actually. Lincoln had another premonition of his own death. He had said that he was looking at himself in the mirror and saw a distorted face, and he took that as a sign that the future looked bleak for him.
And Mary Todd, his wife, also had strange premonitions, didn't she?
Yeah. So once their son Willie died when they were in the White House, and Mary Todd was holding seances regularly to try to contact her son.
Yes.
And just a heartbreaking story, tragedy all around. And so Mary Todd was pretty tuned into that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, not surprising that she would have had some inkling on that as well.
All right, our friend, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch when your book on Kilimanjaro comes out. We'd love to talk with you about that.